The Tom Woods Show, episode 1674.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Folks, by now you've probably noticed that news about the virus is almost always fact-free hysteria these days. So you need my brand new free ebook, Your Facebook Friends Are Wrong About the Lockdown. Go pick it up at wrongaboutlockdown.com. Hey, everybody, Tom Woods here. All right, we're talking about the South today. This is going to separate the men from the boys. You will not find a voice anywhere within the precincts of official libertarianism that will ever have a kind word to say for the South, because all of them are cowards. All of them want to say things that, maybe you're a little edgy here and there, but definitely nothing that'll get them in trouble with the New York Times. Oh, they would die 1,000 deaths before that. So they'll make sure you know that price controls lead to shortages and free trade is better than tariffs and all these sorts of things we all know, we've all heard a million times, and that are perfectly safe and that won't get their lives ruined. They're great on that, but on anything else, well, forget about it. They'll be on the other side shrieking and screaming and calling people the same names that the New York Times calls you. This is my experience with these people over and over again. And then you try to engage them in conversation. They don't know anything. They don't know anything. So it is not like I'm looking at them thinking that they're maybe in some way morally superior to me or they've really stuck it to me. I look at them and say, these people are vacant between the ears. So I got Brian McClanahan on here. We're going to talk about how it is that George Floyd dies at the hands of police in Minneapolis and everybody wants to take this out on the South, or that's at least a big part of the agenda. We have not cleansed the South enough. That's their response to something. I mean, it's like we're going to go to war with Iraq after Osama bin Laden attacked the towers. You know, I mean, okay. You'd think you want to keep your eye on the ball. But anyway, so you get nothing but grief having a good word to say about the South. But in the old days, you know, libertarians weren't always like this, official libertarians anyway. Liberty Fund, which is the amazing place where they republish old classics in affordable editions and usually quite attractive editions. Liberty Fund released The Southern Essays of Richard M. Weaver, which is a terrific book by a very important person who makes all the folks in the official libertarian precincts look like intellectual pygmies. You compare them to Richard Weaver, it's laughable. They also released a collection of writings by, wait for it, John C. Calhoun called Union and Liberty. Huh. But gee, didn't you know Calhoun's view on slavery? Well, how about that? They thought that Calhoun nevertheless had something valuable to say, as did countless European observers who thought that Calhoun was pretty much the only interesting thinker the United States ever produced. And there is a lot of value if you read him. None of these people have read him. So I thought today's a good day to bring Brian back on. And by an interesting coincidence, Brian is the author of a brand new book on the South, and trying to carve out and explain what the Southern tradition really is all about, not the crazy caricature you get in the media and from the alleged experts, but in reality, what is the Southern tradition really all about? So the book is called Southern Scribblings by our guest, Brian McClanahan. Brian, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Tom. I really appreciate it.
I'm glad you put out your version of my book, Real Dissent, which is, I'm sure, not what you had in mind, but it's the same sort of thing. You've written so much over the years in so many different places, and it would be nice to bring it all together, especially because there are common themes, and so you can arrange it, organize it in a way that's helpful for people. And I really feel like, even though I think I've got a couple of books that make original contributions, I have other books that I think popularize some knowledge people need to have, and that I sat down and wrote as start to finish from scratch projects. Actually, Real Dissent is my favorite among my books because it's a sampling of all the sorts of themes I've talked about. And it's really punchy because they're shorter pieces. And when you're writing a longer book, you tend to become ponderous in spite of yourself. So this is perfect. This is exactly what the times require. So that's not even a question, but you can respond however you want.
Well, what your listeners need to know is I was really going to title, actually, my first title for the book was Real Dissent.
There you go. Yeah.
No.
Parentheses, yes. Not this bullshit from Woods, right?
Yeah, so that was the first title. There's a funny story behind that, too. When I was in when I was an undergraduate and I was working on Delaware, which, you know, my advisor as an undergraduate worked on Maryland during the war. So when I was working on Delaware, people used to tell me his book was entitled The South's First Casualty. And so, people used to say you should name it The South's Real First Casualty, right? So you could, but anyways. I wanted to collect, as you said, everything that I had written over the years on the South, because I mean, looking at what's happening right now, it's so timely. I mean, of course, this has been years in the making, but how many things do you see? Pull up any news site. Well, I mean, this is we're going to tear down this, we're going to do this, we're going to take down this symbol, to change this name, whatever it is. And it all has to do with the South. And so the question is, first of all, what do all these things have to do with the South anyways? And why are they going after this stuff? And of course, as early as 2015, well, even before that, 2015, when you had all this really get ramped up, I was interviewed for the Christian Science Monitor, and the interviewer smugly said, well, you know, why is it you're so against these monuments? Shouldn't we just take them down? And I said, well, look, I mean, what happens then? Where do you go? Of course, you're going to go to the founders. They're next. And he didn't believe, no, that's never going to happen. Well, look what's happening, right? Caesar Rodney was taken out of Rodney Square in Wilmington. Caesar Rodney. I mean, this is preposterous. But when you look at this book and all the things that I put into it, it's not just the defense, of course, of, you know, monuments or symbols, but also the principles behind the Southern tradition, why I think it's still valuable in America today, things like political decentralization. When you look at issues of incompatibility between Americans, which we see on a regular basis, I mean, why aren't we talking about decentralization? Why is this thing such a bad word? I mean, we say nullification or secession or these things. Well, not everyone thinks that now. And again, it's my contribution to that conversation. And I wanted it all in one collection so people could just go get it and they could go read through it. And all the essays are shorter. They're punchy. I've got a couple of longer essays in there, but most of them are, you know, 5 or 6 pages, not long. And I hope that people really enjoy reading them.
Let me give you my uncharitable reading of why at least some people are jumping on the Hate the South bandwagon. And let me give you a little sneak preview of where I'm going with this. It's not that they did an impartial survey of the literature and concluded that the Southern tradition has nothing to be said for it. Okay, that has nothing to do with what's going on now. I think for some people, and here I'm thinking about just the average person who doesn't want to get in trouble, libertarians who want to signal to the world that we're not like those bad libertarians over there. We have all the approved opinions. We just want free trade. That's the where we disagree with the mainstream. You know, like whatever. I don't know what these people. But here's the thing. To go along with this narrative of, well, slavery is the only real thing in the Southern tradition. The only way to go along with that is to basically not know anything. But not knowing anything is easy. You know, it requires no effort. Mm-hmm. Whereas actually knowing something about Southern history involves effort. And once you exert that effort, you're going to be hated if you spread anything you learned. So there really isn't a heavy incentive for people to do it. It's much easier to just, assuming most Americans don't know anything, and on this subject they absolutely do not, just assume nobody knows anything and then posture morally in public by just denouncing the South. Because that doesn't require any study. It doesn't require any work. And you get praised and lauded by everybody. Whereas the path you've taken involves a lot of study and being reviled. Well, that's not very attractive to a lot of people. I mean, I honestly think it is flat out cowardice and laziness on the part of a lot of people.
Well, you're exactly right. And my path down this direction, you know, I didn't start out thinking the things I do. You and I have talked about this before on your show.
But plus, you were born in Delaware.
Right. Right. How did you come to the position? Well, it's because I read stuff and I thought, well, my gosh, wait a second here. If I'm going to be this conservative, you think back to your progression through your political views. And we started as conservatives. Well, we talk about limited government. And then you go out and you read, well, the limited government people love Alexander Hamilton, or they love, you know, limited government's good as long as the other side is doing something we don't like. But as soon as we get in power, we're going to do everything we want and we're going to use big government. And so you start thinking about these things and who are the real limited government guys, at least in the antebellum period? I mean, we can get into the debate as how limited government the Confederacy was, but that's a whole nother monster. But leading up to it, when you look at Abel Upshur and St. George Tucker and, of course, the Jeffersonians and all these people and what they said about these things, Nathaniel Macon, the old Republicans, how do you not start John Taylor? How do you start not, how do you not admire those people over time when you start reading what they said? And so it, you're right. Once you open that up, well, you open up the Pandora's box. But once you start saying, hey, you know what? I think Abel Upchurch had something valuable to say. Slavery, right? I mean, you've done the zombie. Well, that's just slavery. That's all he had to say. Or Saint, you know, I think St. George Tucker was pretty spot on with this. Well, yeah, but he was a slave owner. So, I mean, where do you, you're right. You can't say anything because immediately you're going to be painted as, you know, whatever. You might as well just be a Nazi. I mean, as you've said on your Twitter account, you know, if you went out to get a haircut now, you're a Nazi. Well, if you say anything to pro-South, you're definitely a Nazi. I mean, there's various degrees of Nazis. And this is, it's just so stupid. We live in such a stupid time that it's difficult to navigate this. And of course, I get a lot of people telling me I'm stupid all the time because of things I say. But
yeah, but they think you're stupid because you aren't repeating the two sentences worth of knowledge that they think they have.
Right.
And that makes you stupid. Don't you read the news? Everyone is saying X and you're saying Y. You must be stupid. No, I actually think it's the opposite for that exact reason. You know, incidentally, I'm reminded of what Eugene Genovese said. Now, he's I forget when he died, but it was some years ago. He was a great Southern historian, had been a Marxist for most of his life, then toward the end of his life, more or less came to his senses. But he said two things that I want to cite. One, he said, when you go to some small Southern college in the middle of nowhere and you start talking Southern history, they're going to call you on every misplaced semicolon. He said, but if you go give a lecture before the Ivy League, don't worry about it. Nobody's going to know anything. Those are his exact words, his exact words. And that is, of course, very much true. Well, then the second thing that I want to quote, now this may be from his book, The Southern Tradition. I can't remember what the source is, but I've quoted it in my own stuff. And he says that of the five Virginians who made the greatest intellectual contributions to the strict constructionist interpretation of the Constitution, George Mason, Thomas Jefferson, John Randolph of Roanoke, St. George Tucker, and John Taylor of Caroline, only Taylor could be described as pro-slavery. And even he regarded it as an inherited misfortune to be tolerated rather than celebrated. Mm-hmm. Well, how about that? So, right. But if you are to defend the ideas of these men, as I have, well, you know, it's open season on you, right? Obviously, mm-hmm. you want to enslave people and all the rest. And the thing is, I know that when people do this to me and you, they think they're really sticking it to us. But honestly, when you talk to me like that, I just think you're an idiot. You know, I mean, like you're not, I don't feel wounded in any way. I just say, what an idiot. I just move on. Well,
It's self-righteous delusional disorder. I mean, these people are delusional. And they think that, you know, I brought it up. There was a guy that was, you know, trying to pepper me on an email. And usually I don't engage, but this guy was particularly obnoxious. So I had to respond to him. But he was a Vietnam vet. He couldn't understand that what he was attacking me for, had kind of this streak in him where he was, you know, questioning Vietnam but he couldn't see that they're the same. I mean, what he was attacking me for was saying, what do you, the South had something to say about imperialism but they're just, I mean, these people are just evil. And he couldn't understand that the same ideology that drove that war on the South also drove the war in Vietnam. And so they don't get it because they're just been saturated with nationalism. I mean, there's so many things going on here that are working against us. I've said on my own show, it's like you're standing in front of Mount Everest and somebody says, you know, go climb that. And all you got on is shorts and flip-flops and you got to get to the top. It's really hard. But I just couldn't be me if I didn't do it. And, you know, there's a calculated risk in all of this. This is what I think about things. And so, I wanted to, again, put it into a collection of essays so people could read it and digest it in a way that they don't have to go look for all these things over the internet or, you know, try to find them on their own.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I could save myself a lot of grief by just not touching these subjects. A lot of grief.
Right.
But it's like I'm not going to sit in that 1984 room and let them shine a light in my eyes and tell me 2 + 2 = 5 and make me repeat it. I'm just not doing it. I don't care what that means for me. I will not do it. And the sort of people who come after you and me are people who, they have no idea what that's like. Absolutely no idea. And I was just saying the other day, we're dealing half the time with people who are affirmed in their views everywhere they turn. Mm-hmm. Entertainment, academia, the political class of almost both parties, by and large. Every news source, everywhere, they're affirmed in their ideas. And half of them think they're oppressed. And I guess my view is, try walking a mile in my shoes, where you feel despised and loathed in your own country.
Yeah.
Where, you know, if you weren't a firebrand like me, you'd be afraid to say anything about what you believe, about almost anything, a lot of important topics. Mm-hmm. You don't dare say anything. Try being that person, where you're actually reviled by all the influential people. None of these people could take it, and yet they're gonna lecture me for being backward or stupid. At least I have some stones. Now, having said that, let's get into what will be the quite understandable initial objection, Brian. And of course, it's one that you've had to talk about quite a bit, and that is not there's no cartoon answer to it. Mm-hmm. But people will say, look, why do we need a Jefferson Davis statue, for example? Because after all, he led a country that was based on slavery. Mm-hmm. And you may come back and say, well, you can't single him out because George Washington and Thomas Jefferson also led a country. Yeah, they want to topple those statues too.
Right.
So that argument doesn't work anymore. So, I mean, you have to address that.
Right.
So and it's not easy to do briefly because you've written so much about it, but how do you?
Well, I mean, look, we'll go with Taylor Swift. I'm sure you've seen recently here. She said she doesn't want to have any monuments in America dedicated to races. So we got to take down Confederate monuments. Now, think about how stupid that statement is to begin with. No monuments to races. Well, but only Confederate monuments have to come down. So why don't we go after the Lincoln Memorial? Look, amazingly enough, I'm sure you saw, but it was actually graffitied during all the mob protests and everything. Somebody put graffiti on the Lincoln Memorial, which was fantastic. So if we're going to take down everything to races, well, yes, we need to take down everything then. But when you look at what these men represented, and I'll go back to Booker T. Washington for a minute, because Washington was asked, of course, if you don't know, I'm hoping your listeners know who Booker T. Washington
was. Oh, they do. Yeah, they do.
Okay, right. But when Washington was asked at one point, and of course, you know, Mises being in Auburn, the town over from Auburn is Opelika, Alabama. Opelika, Alabama has a Confederate monument. And Washington was asked, would he help raise money for this Confederate monument? And he wrote back and he said, yes, I will help you raise money for the monument. Why? Because the South should have memorials to its greatest people and the people of its greatest character. And I'm paraphrasing, but essentially that's what he said. And so when you look at Jefferson Davis and you look at who he was as an individual, beyond just the president of the Confederate States or Robert E. Lee, or you take the people that have been memorialized in these statues. And we can quibble with some or the other. I mean, look, should this person have been there, this person, or whatever the case may be. But these people were recognized across not just the South, but also the United States as important Americans. I mean, Jefferson Davis was the Secretary of War. I mean, the Capitol building would not look what it does today without Jefferson Davis. So Jefferson Davis was not just an important man in the South, he was an important man in America. And when you look at the principles that for which the Confederacy fought, which is self-determination, that is an American principle. We can talk about why they did it or why they didn't do it or why they fought. But the whole idea of self-determination is purely American. Now, as far as, you know, the South fighting for slavery, that would mean the North was fighting against slavery, which we know they weren't, not in 1861. We know we had two slaveholding republics fighting each other. There were still slaveholding states in the Union. There were still people that were anti-black in the Union. There were still racists in the Union. So we had two racist slaveholding republics fighting against each other for Union, not for any other moral reason. In fact, I loved it when Michael Malice tweeted the other day that the last time Atlanta had, again, I can't remember exactly how he said it, but the last time Atlanta faced any kind of burning was when a bunch of white supremacists came down and occupied. And of course, he's talking about 1865. Right? Sherman's March. So, I mean, this is funny. And it was a funny quote. And I think it most people didn't get it. It went right over their heads, but it was hilarious. And that's where I would say, well, look, I mean, if we know you want to take down Washington, I mean, the attack is not just on the South. It's really on Western civilization. It's on the core principles of America. It's pro-power. It's pro-centralization. It's to get what they want. As you said, if you stop with Davis, you won't stop there. They'll go with Washington, they'll go with Jefferson. So why should we memorialize these people? Well, because they represent the best of American society, and that would be self-determination. to its core, I think that's the thing that always attracted me to the Southern tradition and that founding period as well. I mean, it's that patriotic spirit that is real patriotism, not nationalism.
Southern history and the Southern tradition are not, let's say, held up for sympathetic examination by pretty much anybody these days, because the conservative movement couldn't care less because, frankly, they don't know anything and they're happy not knowing anything. Again, it would be like actively trying to acquire a bad habit. Like, you know that the bad habit is going to do you no good. And imagine having to make an effort to bring about that bad habit. Why would you do that? Mm-hmm. Well, likewise, again, standing up for the South isn't going to bring you any professional plaudits. It's only going to make you a pariah. So, and I have to do extra reading to figure it out. Forget it. Right. It's not going to happen. So the conservative movement, hopeless. The neocons, because of their left-wing streak, are completely hopeless. So it's really just a very small group of people, scholars like yourself, who are even trying to challenge the narrative on this. And yet the people who oppose it, again, they act like the whole country is white supremacist with systemic so racism funny. Everywhere. And like the whole country favors Confederate statues. I don't see that. I mean, you and I actually are besieged. You know, right. I wonder how these people would react if they actually were besieged. You know?
Right. I mean, it's the boogeyman, right? I mean, you have to have the straw man to knock over the boogeyman. Supposedly, every single historian in America teaches that Confederate statues should stay up. I mean, that's you would believe that if you believe the left narrative that, I mean, these things, they're just symbols of all of our oppression. They have to come down. They've been up here for so long. Everybody supports these things. We're fighting against the man. Really, you're going along with the crowd at this point. I mean, there's nothing out there. And that's because of a natural inclination to want to be liked and not to have to go against the grain. You're right. I mean, why would you do these things? I guess maybe I'm just stupid because I thought that, well, I mean, this is what we're supposed to do. We're supposed to go out and read primary materials, supposed to think about what these people actually said and understand that if we take this moral judgment on these individuals, we have to do it all throughout history. Do we say the same things about Aristotle? Most people will say Aristotle, but they never read Politics. If you've ever read Politics, half the book is about slavery. Right. I mean, it really is. And so, well, we still teach that book and it's okay. So why can't we do that? And why can't we find something valuable? What is true and valuable in the Southern tradition outside? I'm not pro slavery at all. That's what people think. Well, because you say this, I hate slavery. I mean, it's not something that I would ever want anyone to go through or be part of. But because I see value in some other things that they say, there's things that are important to teach America, and not just America, but Western civilization, about these great individuals who did things that, frankly, most Americans nowadays would be too cowardly to do. Can you imagine anyone? I mean, there are people that would do it, but most Americans, can you imagine most Americans even thinking about saying, you know what, we're just going to leave the Union now, and we're going to vote to do it. We're not just going to say it on Twitter. We're actually going to go do it. We're going to go down. We're going to elect a convention. We're going to send people there. They're going to vote for it. And then we're going to leave and we're going to tell the general government we're not paying attention to you anymore. Can you imagine most Americans doing that? I can't. So that's pretty remarkable. Or can you imagine the founding generation doing the exact same thing? We're going to tell the greatest military power in the world to stick it. And we're going to have our own government here, our own 13 governments. Then we'll get our own little central government later on. But we're going to do that. These are men of action. And I think that's always been the attractive thing about it for me. They put their money where their mouth was, and they certainly believed in principles enough to go do what they said they were going to do instead of just being, you know, a Twitter tough guy. I think that's remarkable. So I don't know. It's you're right. Why would you do this if you just weren't a glutton for punishment? I think because there's something to be said for this. And, you know, eventually, people come around to it. I will say this, you know, even though it seems like, you know, we're climbing Mount Everest with no equipment, there are more people now that come to us, and I'm sure you get it too, that said, you know, gosh, I didn't know anybody else thought like this. I've thought like this for a long time. I didn't know anybody thought like this, and finally somebody's saying something about it. Or even think about Michael Bolden, who does great work at the 10th Amendment Center. You know, Michael Bolden just kind of came around to this, and how many more people are talking about decentralization now because of some of the things we do? And it's remarkable. We've got more traction now than we ever had, and I think that's because there are people waking up, and the internet's the great leveler and all the things we do, the podcasting and writing. And so hopefully we'll get more people over time. It's just the academics, I think, are a lost cause.
When Virginia and Kentucky in 1798 made clear their displeasure with the Alien and Sedition Acts and their intention to refuse to allow their enforcement. This became known as the Principles of 98, and at the time, the New England states in particular made it seem like this was a series of peculiar ideas that these weird Southerners had cooked up. But not 10 years later, those New Englanders were very happy to refer to those ideas when they wanted to object to the embargo of Jefferson, unconstitutional searches and seizures. Daniel Webster wanted to oppose any possibility of a military draft during the War of 1812. There were arguments for free trade that wanted to use the principles of 98. All kinds of issues all over the place. So it goes to show that a lot of times for people, people are just not principled. Mm-hmm. It's just, if it's a cause I care about, then sure, we can resist it. You know, we can resist opposition to us at the federal level. But if it's your cause, like standing up to the federal government that wanted to throw journalists in jail, well, the New England Puritans will tell you that you can't have that. And likewise, this has been the case, like, for example, with the lockdowns. Mm-hmm. Well, we think you need to stay in your house for these various reasons. And then all of a sudden, when the George Floyd death occurs and everybody goes outside, that you actually had healthcare professionals saying fighting white supremacy is a public health issue. So we need to go. So now, you know, your grandmother, you would have killed your grandmother if you went out 3 months ago. But you know what? The old hag has had three solid good months now. She's had a pretty good run. Right. And now the cause is important enough that we ought to make her a martyr for it. In other words, even progressives deep down, there are some of them who believe in the idea of self-determination and local mm-hmm. self-government. Look at what's going on in Seattle. Look at what went on with California, with some of them talking about secession after Trump got elected. We mm-hmm. all favor systems where we feel like we have more of a voice.
Right.
Everybody feels that way. So how about saying, well, you know what? Maybe I have something in common with those people I've demonized and caricatured my whole life. Maybe this is a time for us to have a meeting of the minds. Would never, ever occur to them.
No. Well, I mean, I look at Kirk Sale, right? Kirkpatrick Sale is a leftist, but he's a good leftist.
He's the best of the leftists.
Right. He's someone that says, you know what? We disagree, but we can just disagree separately.
So yeah. Hello.
You can have. Why are you forcing people into this union that doesn't work any longer? And when you talk about George Floyd, I mean, the question is always, you know, first of all, that happened in Minnesota. What does that have to do with Alabama? My first statement was, my gosh, there are racists in Minnesota. I never knew because
you would only thought it was only a Southern problem.
Right. So, oh my God. What does this have to do with Alabama? Is this not an issue that Minnesota can deal with on its own? Looking at the issue of police powers I'm sympathetic with this stuff. I mean, it was a horrible situation. But the response has been this pogrom just on all things, you know, traditional, because that's really the agenda. And, you know, you talk about the staying home and, my father died March 5th. We didn't get to have a funeral because he died. And then COVID hit a week later, his funeral was canceled. We haven't had anything. But I can go out if I just say it's a protest. I guess we should just call it a protest.
You could say it was a protest against the Grim Reaper.
Right.
That was so what the funeral was.
We're going to have a protest and everybody's going to get up there and we're just going to protest whatever we want to protest. So we could do it that way. But a lot of people are suffering with this and it's all about power and authoritarianism. And you're right. People are inconsistently consistent. And the interesting thing, you bring up 1798. One thing, I can't remember if I talked about in the book or not. I think I did somewhere. I've said it many times in many different areas. But, you know, when you look at nullification, it didn't start in 1798. This is exactly what New England was doing during the Suffolk Resolves. They called it that. They were doing it with the Stamp Act. They were talking about, you know, we're just going to nullify that law because we're just not going to pay attention to it here in New England. Virginia would do the exact same thing if the center in Richmond came up with a law that they didn't like. Well, they just wouldn't enforce it in the courts. So, I mean, that's nullification. It's the American way. We don't live in a French unitary state where the king is the state and they do everything is centralized. We live in a society, a political society that often works from the bottom up. And so I, I, this is something that people, I think some people are starting to come around. Candace Owens actually came out and said, you know, maybe we just need to secede. Maybe we need to give like the left a few states and they can have that. And then we can have the real America. Well, that's a great idea. I mean, I think that's wonderful. And I think if leftists would just really figure this out that, you know, maybe the problem is not what happens in Minnesota if I'm in Alabama or in Alabama if I'm in Minnesota, but maybe the problem is right here. And if we could get our own progressive utopia, which I thought Minnesota was supposed to be that anyways, we could have, you know, something that's beautiful and reflects what we want society. And I'm all for it. You know, you take it, Minnesota, I'm going to live somewhere else because I don't want to live in that. But that would be the most agreeable and peaceful thing to do. And I think, again, that's what always attracted me to this, the idea that we can have these different states. And this is how the founders sold the Constitution. You still have all your differences. You can have all that. We just are going to be unified for commerce and defense, and that's it. And we'll move on from there.
All right, a couple more things. We did a whole week together, you and I, Brian McClanahan week some time ago. And those episodes, along with all your previous appearances, will be linked on the show notes page, tomwoods.com/1674, in case people think, well, they're not getting into as much detail as I'd like. We did a whole week together on this, folks. There's more detail than you could possibly want in those episodes. But having said that, there are two more things I want to bring up. One is Robert E. Lee, because for a long time, it's funny when you look at Lincoln's attitude and the attitude of a lot of Northerners after the war was quite conciliatory, where basically the attitude was, we'll admit that Reconstruction was a fiasco and you admit that slavery was wrong, and they did. And then the attitude was that there was a lot to be admired about the South, that, you know, this is not a cartoon of angels and devils. There were things to be admired about the South, such that Winston Churchill admired Robert E. Lee. All the presidents, I mean, Eisenhower, Kennedy, Johnson, Nixon, Ford, even Ford, I think, which, I mean, how's that possible? Carter.
He pardoned you. He pardoned Lee. Yeah.
Yeah. Reagan, all the way down to Bill Clinton. But now suddenly, even that can't be allowed anymore. Like, this was like one, at least the Southerners could say we had Robert E. Lee and everybody realized he was an honorable man. But now they can't have even that. Mm-hmm. And you have a chapter in here called Robert E. Lee versus Twitter Historians.
Right. It's one
that sounds like a headline I would have come up with.
Yeah, it's one of the best chapters in the book by far. And what I did, there was this piece by in The Atlantic, the myth of the kindly General Lee. And it's, if you go on social media, you'll see it. It comes around about once every month. Somebody posts it somewhere. And this is the definitive refutation of the fact that Lee was a good man. And basically what they did is they took, there was a book by Pryor entitled Reading the Man. And they took this book and they ran with some of the things in it. And they talk about how Lee was a vicious slave owner who ordered that is some runaways that he had recaptured be whipped and brine poured in their wounds, that he, of course, was a traitor. I mean, you can't get around that. He's a bad general. You know, he was just an awful guy. You know, he had a foot fetish. I mean, all these weird things about Lee that, you know, this guy just wasn't very good. You shouldn't admire this guy at all. He was just a miserable man. And what I did, he favored the KKK. I mean, these are the things that are there. So what I did in this particular piece is that, okay, well, let's take this piece. And I'll go back and I'll look at all the arguments and then I'll look at the primary source material and see if there's anything to this, right? So, of course, I knew there wasn't, but I was just going to do it in a very, very academic way. So one part where they talk about the slaves, this is a big one. You know, Lee had, after his, he assumed the estate of his wife's father when he died. And, of course, that's the Custis family who was, of course, related to George Washington, right? So, by marriage, you know, Washington marries Custis into the Custis family. And so Washington did not have his own children. And so all of his wife's, you know, Martha's children became his children and then grandchildren and great grandchildren on down the line. So that was the affiliation. So Lee had to manage the estate. And at one point, when he took over the estate, the slaves in the Lee estate were not required to work at all, which, I mean, because they were promised their freedom, and so they weren't. So Lee had to get the estate solvent. He had to get it to where he could sell it, he could liquidate it, but it had to be in a point where it had to be solvent. So he said, okay, well, we have to get it working again. So he actually made some of the slaves work. And of course, this is seen as barbaric. And looking at slavery, of course, is terrible. I mean, to be in that situation, Lee actually calls it his miserable legacy, all the things he had to do here to try to get the estate solvent. So I acknowledge, I mean, Lee was doing some things that we in the 21st century would say, I mean, that's not good, right? I mean, but you also have to understand he's trying to adhere to the guidelines of the will to do things that the will was telling me how to do. Well, one particular case, a couple of slaves ran away. They were recaptured. And years after, this is, I think it was 1866, there was an abolitionist newspaper that published an account of one of the slaves who chronicled that Lee had them whipped and brine pouring their wounds. The problem is, even Pryor admits, they can't verify this. I mean, they can sort of verify it, but they can't. If you were whipped so severely and brine poured in your wounds, you'd think you would have scars. The slave in question never had scars. I mean, there's all kinds of things where you scratch your head and say, okay, did it really happen? Possibly. Is it conclusive? No, but it's shown as conclusive evidence that Lee had this done. He denied it publicly and privately. And so this is one of the things where I said, okay, well, the evidence doesn't meet what people are saying about Lee. I mean, could it have happened? Certainly. We weren't there. We don't know. But the evidence, when you look at the evidence, it's very hard to say that it conclusively happened, but it's shown as it's conclusive. I mean, this is it. It's proven because somebody said it happened. The other thing was, of course, Lee, and this is my favorite part, where Lee is supposedly turning a blind eye to the KKK when he's at Washington University there before it became Washington Lee. He's the president of the college. And there was one student. This is the overwhelming evidence that Lee supported the Klan while he was the president of Washington College. Because one student wrote a letter to his mom saying that there was a Klan chapter on campus, and Lee turned a blind eye to it. Now, the faculty minutes actually say that Lee addressed this, and they expelled students who engaged in these kind of things. But one student. So my question is, when did one student become become overwhelming evidence of anything? But this is where we are in 21st century historian talk. So that's why I said it's the Twitter historians, because they sit there and put this stuff up there, all these platitude slogans based on this article, based on Pryor's book. But even she admits at times that she can't prove much of the accusations that were being made against Lee. And it's hogwash. I mean, the whole thing is simply, again, 21st century virtue signaling, moral self-righteousness that really doesn't fit with the historical record. So that is one of my favorite pieces. And I go through the end of that piece and I say, what can we actually say about Lee? It's these things about Lee, and you can read it. But these are the things we can say about Lee. These are the things we can't say conclusively about Lee. And I think at the end of the day, when various across the generations, great people have said Robert E. Lee was a great man, I think that's who we should listen to more than the Twitter historians who run their mouths. Like I said, the Twitter tough guys out there.
Yeah. Yeah, none of whom really impress me in any way, intellectually, in any way. All right.
Well,
finally,
one thing I want to say about that: the person I quote some tweets in there, right? The guy that I was quoting, he blocked me. I didn't name him because I know him personally. I didn't name him. I didn't want to embarrass him that much. But I never addressed him. Never talked to him. I haven't talked to him for years. But I went to go look at his feed and he just blocked me. So that's just cowardly. I mean, I'm sorry, but that's cowardly.
Yeah, no kidding. All right, last thing is, we've talked a bit here about the Southern tradition, and it's unfair to say that the South is slavery and nothing else. We did do an episode, you and I, Is There Anything Valuable in the Southern Tradition, it was called. Mm. So we have an episode-length answer to this question, but I feel like for the sake of completeness here, we should tackle that. What does, let me put it the way a third grade teacher might have put it to you. Brian, what does the South mean to you?
Well, you know, there's another piece in there that I really like, and it's entitled, That's What I Like About the South. And you go back to the early 20th century, and I love music. And so when you look at the early 20th century, so much of American music, popular music, was focused on having at least a song or two about the South. And there was a great old song entitled, That's What I Like About the South. And it's fun. And you look at the people that were writing these songs, many of them were African-American, many were Jewish, and yet they're writing these songs that are laudatory of the South. Well, according to the modern narrative, that shouldn't happen. You shouldn't have anybody besides you know, these evil racists writing songs about the South, but everybody did. Why? Because it's the climate's great. The people are nice. The food's great. The music's great. The culture is great. And I think that, you know, for me, and, you know, I know you because you lived in the South too, and people that come down to the South have this preconceived notion as to what it's going to be like. And they get here and they're surprised. Wait a second here. I thought it was going to be like this because this is what everybody's told me, but yet it's not like that at all. And, you know, when you look at things like the African diaspora, the African-American diaspora after the war, when many Black Southerners moved out of the South and moved into northern areas, it's actually working the other way now. If the South was so bad, why are so many African-Americans moving back into the South? Well, because, I mean, it's better than Detroit. It's better than so many other northern cities, Chicago, coming back down here where it's a little slower paced, the crime's not so bad. I mean, it's better. So you have this beautiful part of American culture that, I mean, look, any major form of American music is Southern in origin. There's other than, I think it's polka is what I've been told, only polka. Now, who listens to polka? I mean, that's, so I'm sure you're going to have one listener that says, I listen to polka, but polka is...
half the comments section now is going to be about that.
So I'm sure that somebody will say, well, I'm sorry if I offended you about your polka music. I'm just not a fan. But, you know, polka is one. But almost every major form of American music, you think about literature, you think the greatest, until recently, the greatest director of all time was D.W. Griffith, right? I mean, he was considered as a pioneer. You could talk about Griffith. Now you can't because he produced films that are politically incorrect. And of course, you know, we just can't talk about that anymore. But see, it's because of this idea that you can't separate things from, you know, you can't separate deeds from words from action, this kind of thing. So Griffith was a fantastic director, pioneering. In fact, it wasn't just always pro-Southern. He also did a film on Lincoln, which was very good. I mean, so you have this, you know, because he had a film that's so, I mean, just so vile to most people, you can't say anything good about Griffith. Interestingly enough, did you ever listen to Smashing Pumpkins?
I know of them, but I never listened to them.
Okay. They have an album entitled Gish. And Lillian Gish, it's named after Lillian Gish, who was the primary actress in almost all of D.W. Griffith's films. Now, I wonder why nobody's going, and she was, you know, big, I mean, she and Griffith were good. I wonder why nobody's going after that album saying you got to change the name because that's now, you know, that's a non-PC. You can't have somebody that was named after this horrible person in all these racist films for a left-wing band to have an album named Gish. So, look, the South offers so much to American society in terms of culture. And of course, politically, we've talked about it several times on this episode, decentralization, the principles of self-determination, these type of things. There's so much to admire and like about the South. But if you just live in a world of platitudes and slogans, you're never going to get beyond, as you say, the 3x5 index card of allowable opinion. Once you do, once you just come off, just scribble off the side of the card just a little bit, it opens up a whole world to you. If you're really intellectually curious, you should be looking at Southern history and Southern society and what it can really offer. I mean, Americans for years thought it was the exotic other in American society. It was something that was different. I mean, I tell a story. I had a guy email me one time. He said he had some Chinese businessmen come over. He was in Texas. And there was back in the 80s, this was an exchange program they were doing. And these guys couldn't even speak English, really. And they came over here, and you think about China in the 80s, about 1984. You think about China in the 80s and what it was. It was still very repressive. And they didn't even know where Dallas, they were in Dallas. They didn't know where Dallas was on the map. But the very first thing they said to him, and he said, all right, what do you want to see? I mean, here you are in Dallas. If you were in Dallas, what would you want to see? If you were touring, if you went there now, you'd never been there before, what would you want to see in Dallas? If you think from an outsider, what would be one important place to see in Dallas for you?
Oh, well, for me, probably the site where Kennedy was shot.
Right. I mean, if you're most Americans, that's what you're going to think. Well, I'm going to go. Not these Chinese businessmen. They wanted to go see the statue of Robert E. Lee. That's what they wanted to see. That was everything to them. Because why? Well, he represented the South. And so you think about all the people that would come to the South and want to see these Southern monuments and Southern. Do you go? I mean, how many people go to the South and they want to see a plantation home? This is what they want to see. It's something. It's like when you go to Greece or you go to Athens or you go to Rome, you want to see the ruins. You want to see the civilization. These are things you want to see. And I think that when people get, again, get off that index card and they start looking at these things, there's so much beauty in the South. And gosh, I mean, it's amazing to me why they just are so intellectually dishonest or so closed-minded. They can't just do it for a second. If they did, it would open up just a wonderful world to them.
Well, the book is Southern Scribblings. I'm going to link to it at tomwoods.com/1674. Written by Brian McClanahan, our guest today. And of course, you should listen to the Brian McClanahan Show. Brian has a podcast. He's got a crazy life right now. I guess I probably won't give the details, but you have a lot going on right now. And yet somehow he still produces all the stuff he produces. It's astonishing. He does very important work. I'm delighted to say that Brian is among the faculty at libertyclassroom.com, which you should go and avail yourselves of. But definitely pick up Brian's book, linking to it on the show notes page. Brian, thanks so much. Hope to see you next month sometime.
Thanks, Tom. Appreciate it.
All right, folks, that's our episode for today. Check out Brian's book. Check out my free ebook, Your Facebook Friends Are Wrong About the Lockdown. You can find that at wrongaboutlockdown.com. Or if you're in the United States, you can also text the word lockdown to the number 33444 and get the ebook delivered to you that way. Doesn't cost you a thing. Thanks for listening, everybody. See you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.